You're listening to episode 18 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
I'd love to thank Scrivener for sponsoring today's episode. Scrivener is a tool that helps writers bring their stories to life. I use Scrivener to gather all my thoughts, ideas, and research in an organized way that makes writing the chapters so much easier for me. Stay tuned for a featured interview with Julia Pierce, the head of marketing at Scrivener, at the end of this episode to find out why she uses Scrivener, the one feature she absolutely loves, and the very special promo code just for our tribe of storytellers. Hey, storytellers, we have director-writer Morgan Krantz with us today. His directorial feature film debut, Babysitter, world premiered at South by Southwest. Babysitter is about Ray Longway, a moody teenager who's a pawn in his parents' bitter divorce. His mother, a struggling actress who married rich, has grown accustomed to their cushy LA lifestyle, but now this lifestyle is threatened and depends solely on Ray's custody decision. The family hires a Wiccan practicing babysitter, Angelica, who quickly fills a void in everyone's lives. After sharing a joint one night, Ray and Angelica form a deep bond that unfolds into something strange and profound, but their entanglement is poised to jeopardize Ray's mother's master plan. I had such a great time chatting with Morgan, and for his episode, I'll be diving right into the middle of our interview where we start to talk more about his filmmaking choices and career. I'm so impressed by all that Morgan has accomplished at such a young age, so let's jump right in.
I feel like so many people have work that they want to put out there, but it's always when it comes to the financing part that holds them back from actually bringing it into fruition, which is unfortunate, you know? So what would you advise from your own experience financing and being able to get investors or find investors for your film to make it happen?
Yeah, I mean, I've been very lucky with finding money for it. I think that it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that the first thing is that you really have to believe in it and yourself. And if you do, then it'll give you the fire that you need to basically, you know, say to somebody like, hey, give me your money and mean it. That's first and foremost, obviously. And then I think I was just very lucky. And also because largely Luke Bayback was completely instrumental in assembling the financing. And he and I had done a short film together that we financed through, you know, essentially this list that we got of these businessmen in a very sort of random industry of like mining. And we got this through some of Luke's connections. These were not people who are in any way interested in film or have ever showed any evidence of being interested in film. But what we did know about them is that they potentially had no money. So we basically, what I did was I assembled a whole video presentation, a whole pitch of the film, because if you're going to people who aren't in the film industry to give you money, they are not going to understand a script and they're not going to read, they don't read scripts. It's not something they do. So a video is, I would say, for sure the way to go. And we made this video, not unlike a Kickstarter video. Instead of Kickstarter, we were just going to these guys. And both those routes, though, I think are really, it's a lot of work. You know, it's like you can nickel and dime people on Kickstarter, or if you happen to have a list, as I did, of like theoretical rich folks, then you could do that. Both require tremendous amounts of energy, and I think you should just go with whatever's available to you. But we went that way with this video, and then on top of the video, you know, I made like a whole spreadsheet, like a whole kind of visual kind of treatment, very easy to read, very easy to get it. This is the movie, here's what it looks like, here's the vibe, and here's the whole thing.
I'm curious, you mentioned about the video part. Did you add sort of like a sizzle reel in there just to kind of give them a tease? Because I know there are some Kickstarter videos where you actually see the director's face asking you for money. There are others where it's a commercial, like a trailer. What was your video like?
Yeah, we basically did all of everything. There was a face-to-face thing, me, you know, interview thing of me talking and Luke talking, Eric talking. And then we also put together, you know, then I had like a little samplings of my work in there. And the whole thing was VO driven, which is a good way to do it. It's a voiceover driven kind of video, or text titles, I think is actually what we landed on. So it's like Morgan's work, you know, and then you show like a few clips, some of my more impressive shots from my short films, music videos, and web content that I had done. And then what I did was I spent probably like a week in front of my computer just scouring Vimeo and YouTube and films and downloading all of these films and clips and stuff. And I sort of assembled a feel reel. That's what we ended up calling the thing. So I put together this like feel reel of the movie. So as I told the story verbally in voiceover, I'm giving this pitch, you're seeing moments from like other films or just stuff like that not you don't even recognize. That, you know, like Vimeo is actually a wonderful resource for this. You can rip some videos off of there. I don't think you can, you know, we weren't putting this video public, so I don't know what the like legality is on there, but this was a private video. So I ripped off like a lot of nice music videos and short films with pretty photography and emotional things happening that kind of spoke to my story. And I would put that under my voiceover, you know, just to really like paint the picture. And then, you know, we really tried to hook them with like, here's who I am. Here's who everybody is. Here's what the movie's about. This is why the movie's awesome. This is why the movie's relevant, blah, blah, blah. You hook them with that. And then you hit them in the video with the numbers, you know, and you say like, we need, you know, X amount of dollars. Then this is what's going to happen to the movie. You know, this is where we're going to submit it, and giving it all lots of visual stuff. You know, I'd be like, you know, we're going to submit it to film festivals. And then I'd have like important film festival laurels, like pop up on the screen. And then after that, you get it distributed. And then I show like all the like logos of that. So they are really getting it, because we were, you know, particularly for us, we're speaking to people who didn't know the industry. They knew business and they understood investment. Like the first question that most of these guys were asking is like, well, how do you make money?
Exactly. What would they get in return?
So we tried to come in with that right away, all up front in the video. That way it's all very up front, very like, here we are, here's what we need. And we tried to answer like all the questions and really make it like a captivating sales cycle, because essentially it was a sales video.
I am curious though, what are they getting in return? Like besides film festival recognition?
It's a really a case by case thing. I don't think that anybody invests in film for the money solely. It's certainly not a movie like this. I don't think actually any of our guys, and there were many of them who kind of nickel and dimed, you know, all of them had like some other motivation for being a part of it. Some of them just really liked movies. For some guys, it's like something a little risky, but you have to be upfront in the sense that like, you know, I mean, they're not idiots either. Everybody knows that film is like a high risk investment. If you want to invest in something that's going to make guaranteed money, you know, you go to like a CD account or bonds or silver or something like that. You know, you definitely don't go to movies. So these are guys that maybe like had whatever X amount of dollars they maybe had to throw around, and they wanted to like exoticize their portfolio, or maybe they had like a daughter or something that like had an interest in coming to LA to try out acting, you know, and so they're interested in building relationships, or they're interested in, you know, maybe just movies. Like if they just love movies and they're just like, yeah, movies are awesome and I've always loved movies and like I want to be a part of it.
Yeah, they all have their reasons.
They all have their own reasons. I don't think we have anyone who put money solely for the sake of money. I don't think that was ever like the primary motivation.
What was the most difficult scene that you worked with in Babysitter that you really felt like it challenged you as a director, and how did you get past it?
Certainly the most challenging aspect of the story was the ending, something that I shot 3 times actually. Because the first time we shot it, it was kind of just badly planned. And we had the idea of like trying to get all this like sunset stuff. And anybody who's made a few things knows that you're always going to have a DP who rightfully wants to do it. You know, they want that light to be like perfect. And so you're like, okay, yeah, we can do all this and like hit our, we can be at this point by the time the sun is right here and blah, blah, blah. So the first time we shot it, we finished the day, but like half of the scene was like ended in night. It like began in day and ended in night. And then after that, kind of had to go back and like pick up all kinds of stuff to basically really get the ending that we wanted to get. And then I was, you know, working. I was cutting the film forever and and I was like working on that ending, and I just wasn't really feeling it. I was really vibing with everything up until the ending. And then I had this vision. And, you know, this was some advice that I got actually at Maryland Film Festival a year or so before I made the film. I was there and I like went to some panel or something. And one of the guys who just made a movie was talking about the importance of budgeting for reshoots and pickups, and just how much that'll kind of save your ass. And the wonderful thing about it is that you can cut the film and then you can kind of watch the film and kind of listen to the film. And this, you know, because the script is like nothing. What it really comes down to is like the people, the actors in the space, and you know, what you're doing with camera and all that stuff. But the movie takes its own life. If you can, I would always say just try to factor in there, at least for me. I can't imagine, like, you know, making something, cutting it together and being like, yep, nailed it. At least not right now. I mean, I aspire to go to get there, but I know that I'm not there right now. So it was very important to me that I'd be able to cut the film, watch the film and be like, what is it, you know, like kind of listen to it, where it wants to go and what's happening with it all, you know? So I did that one night. I had this cut and I like sat back by myself with a glass of wine or something. And I kind of just had this idea for the ending and was like, oh my God, that's it. And then I had to sit on the idea for like a week because I was dreading telling Luke that we had to do it again. Because I mean, you know, it's hard because you put everybody through all of this stuff and then you're like, you know, we had already done a reshoot to get the ending that we missed the first time, and we did it, and it was like this huge production again. And then to be like, oh, wait, no, it's this actually.
How did you handle that as the leader of your production?
If your intentions are really to just make the best film, and you can acknowledge the fact that, like, in the earlier stages of your creative career, you know, it's like all you're trying to do is like get it right, you know? And if you're just very upfront about the fact that, like, we didn't nail it and it's not it, I just want to make it the best that it can be, you know? I mean, people may be a little unsettled by, like, doing something again or changing something like that. But that's only because film is a particularly rigid format. It's not an easy thing to change. It's not like a novel or something, you know? You can't just, oh, let me just go to my computer and change that ending. You know, it's like you got to assemble 50 people, whatever. Not 50 for us, but...
How big was your crew, by the way?
Oh, it was small. I mean, we were like 20 heads, I think. I love shooting that way. And that's how we ended up getting the final ending was with even less than that. The final ending we shot was like maybe five of us, just a camera. We didn't even need sound for it. So it was very easy and very nice, very fluid. You know, there's benefits, there's virtues and liabilities to both, of course, you know, to being lean and mean. There's some wonderful things about that and some drawbacks as well. Same with being on a bigger, you know, having like all the resources you need and everybody on post in the right positions. And, you know, that has many wonderful things about it, but also definite drawback.
For your scenes and locations, were any of them shot guerrilla style where you maybe have not gotten the permit?
Oh, totally, man. It's a hard thing because I don't know. I mean, I particularly like when I'm in the mode of like when we're making a movie and all that. Like I have a particular, you know, sense of entitlement that I shamelessly move forward on, you know, that I'm just like, it's like I'm making a movie. This is a service to the world.
Right. That's awesome.
And, you know, I just go and I'll steal anything if I think I can get away with it. It's sketchy, too, because, you know, the drawback of that, I'm saying this because mainly I had a music video that I did like years ago and we stole this like government location. And I was so nervous the whole time. I was just so stressed out that we were going to get busted that it really affected my fun level and my ability to just direct. You know, I was pretty nervous about it because it was pretty sketchy. And every time like a helicopter would fly by, I would be like, oh, my God, like hide everybody. And, you know, so like that's the drawback. And the of course, the real drawback is if you get busted, then you... You know, you're standing there with 30 people looking at you like, are you an idiot? But I think, you know, if you think you can get away with it, just do it. But just be pretty sure you can get away with it, you know? So yeah, we stole all kinds of stuff. And like the ending thing that I had to reshoot, you know, by the time I finally figured out what the ending was for the film, we went to shoot it. That was a location that was owned by, well, I won't tell you who, but it was owned by a particular government organization. And, you know, we had already paid them, you know, some ridiculous amount of money. And I talked Luke into just stealing it because I was like, I justified this criminal activity by telling myself that we had already paid them so much. You know, you got to have your own morals and principles. But I guess that I, as long as nobody's getting hurt, and I think there's an ethics to it, you don't want to, I don't know. It's a specific thing. I guess there's ways that you could probably steal locations that would be dangerous and harmful that is not wise. Like the thing that happened on that whatever movie where the camera operator, I think her name is Sarah Jones. That's like an example of like extreme idiocy. So, you know, I'm definitely not an advocate of that.
But you're talking about like a park or something when no one's there and no one's going to get hurt with any camera equipment.
I think everybody's different that way, and you kind of just have to be yourself in that way. Like, I know that there's, I know I certainly have friends who are like filmmakers, producers and stuff that, you know, they're just people who are not comfortable bending rules or anything. And so I couldn't see them doing that. And I think it would make them too nervous to do it. So it's like, they might as well just come up with an extra grand or whatever it's going to be to do it the proper way, which is obviously, if you can afford it, is a much more calm way of doing it.
If you could do it again, what would you change differently?
About the prep process?
Yeah.
Definitely stick it out, which I think I'm in less of a catch-22 position because now I've made a film. So I hope, I can only imagine and pray that it'll be a little easier to get the money next time. Maybe. I also know that I have a little better taste of my process. You know, I understand how I work better. So I think what I would do is I would probably wait, get all the money there, at least to get us through the shoot, you know, and I would have all that in place. And I would make sure to hire the right people. Just like make sure that you are assembling the right team around you and that everybody is going to be doing it for the right reasons and that they're like nourished and by the process and all of that, you know, because especially on an indie movie, like you're not getting paid. You're working like ungodly hours, particularly in prep for 6 weeks at a time. I guess I would also probably focus less on the script. That was kind of my way of wigging out, was like, I became obsessed with rewriting, like literally up until the night before our first day of shooting. And then throughout the shooting, I kept like rewriting, tweaking out on the script. The script is like nothing, you know, it doesn't matter. Like you just need the script so that people know like where to go and what to bring.
Did you storyboard your script in the end?
Yeah, a lot of the sequences I did. And then a lot of them were kind of just felt out. I mean, it's a simple movie, you know, there's not a lot of crazy choreography or anything. So a lot of it I would block with the actors in rehearsal if I could, and then get an idea for the shots.
Yeah, I felt like the scenes were so heavily dependent on the actors' performances. So I'm sure you had a lot of rehearsal time during prep, yeah?
Yeah, we had some. And I think, you know, we used it pretty well. Like, and I was able to do this past weekend, you know, on this short I made, mm-hmm. Is to really use the rehearsal time. I think I was in a place of nervous hysteria where I was using the rehearsal time as some sort of way of reassuring myself that this was going to work. If I had to do it again, I would really open it up and just be like, let's fuck it up.
Yeah, I think you put way too much pressure on making it perfect the first time around.
Absolutely. It's great to get it over because when you're done with it, you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, you know, I didn't die.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to keep making movies. And so you can become a little less precious about it. But yeah, you know, you feel at the beginning of that first feature thing, you think like, well, this is like the defining thing. This is going to define me and everything in my life. And you feel totally crazy. I think that the filmmaking is a pressure cooker. You willingly put yourself into this pressure cooker, and wherever you have a weak spot, you know, it will give. It will blow.
What's up for you next?
I made a web series before I made Babysitter called Neurotica.
Nice.
Which was a very popular online thing, got millions of views, which was super exciting.
Are we talking what kind of online?
It was on YouTube, and it still exists on YouTube. However, the unfortunate thing is when we sold it to this company.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. We sold it to a company called Endemol. So they're financing us to do more of it, and we're doing that. So we're shooting that in the summer. You can check out the first season online, although I just can't help myself from giving you this side note that we had these millions of views, but when we sold it due to the deal and whatnot that we made, we had to take it off our previous YouTube. So you will not bear witness to the millions of views.
Oh.
No, it's all good. You know, it's for the best because now we're making it like bigger, better, crazier, and it's a really wild fun.
That is so freaking awesome. And by the way, you totally opened up a can of worms. This whole idea of like selling a show from a YouTube series to a company like that is just something that I don't understand because I have no experience with that whatsoever.
It's been a wonderful experience.
Yeah, that's so exciting.
So the show, to tell you a little about it, it's called Neurotica, and it's about this overthinking 20-something guy who I play. He just overthinks everything to the point of like an epic fail, more or less. But the show is told through very much through his point of view, and we have these sequences in which we go into his head, you know, and we sort of see his thoughts and his what's happening in his mind. It's sort of like a Seinfeld on acid or Woody Allen on, you know, shrooms or something. It's definitely an update to those guys, you know, Albert Brooks. These kind of like neurotic Jews, you know, who are kind of like overthinking things and just being all neurotic, I guess, except we're kind of taking it to another level where we are inside of the head of that character. I make it with my good friend and partner on the show called, his name is Alex Marecki. And I met him because he directed me in his first film that I acted in called All Together Now. So we met there and we started to get together. We ended up writing this web series, and we just made it for nothing ourselves. And we put like so much work into it, and they're just 90-second episodes. The new season is going to be longer, but the first season was all like these 90-second episodes. But it's crazy because anything goes in the mind space. So we go to like millions of locations, and you know, we really, Alex and I were both just at that point when we made this first season like 3 years ago now. We were both at this point of like, just really wanted to go like all out and just make something awesome that we liked, you know? And
yeah, absolutely.
We really just wanted to like make each other laugh. I think most comedy writing partnerships are very much born out of that. So we made it and we put it online, and it did very well online. Like I said, millions of views.
Which we will have a screenshot of.
You will. Oh, believe me. But actually, the millions of views thing didn't even happen until later. And what happened was we made it, and then people really liked it. It was just great. People just loved it. And it was the first time, actually, that I made something that I could tell by the way in which people were telling me that they liked it. I was like, oh, I get it. You've never liked anything else. Like, this is what it's like when somebody actually likes the thing that you make. It was a very different feeling. Like, people would be like, hey, man, that's like awesome. And I'd be like, oh, thank you so much. And they'd be like, no, it's awesome. And I'd be like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, you really dig this. That's cool. So what ended up happening was it was on a YouTube channel. And then like that YouTube channel was represented by Mosaic Management Company. Those guys, Mosaic, also represent Lee Eisenberg and Gene Stupnitsky, who are these really awesome, very successful comedy writers. They worked on The Office and they wrote like all these huge comedies, and now they sell like a show every day and they have like 5 shows on the air, and they're great guys. And Mosaic sent it to them and they really liked it. We met with them and then they kind of came on board and wanted us to turn it into a half hour. So we were kind of like, but you know, it's 90 seconds, right? They were like, no, like this can be a half hour show. And we were like, okay.
What an amazing compliment.
Yeah. It was,
that's so awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, it was amazing because the really startling thing about it was that we didn't do anything. Like we weren't even done making the show, and we had already planned on like, yeah, we'll make this, and then we're just going to like move on to something else. We were just putting the work in because I think we just really enjoyed each other's company, and we like just really wanted to make it good, and it meant something to us, you know. And we work like crazy all night, like so insane for no, you know, like there was just no return on it. It didn't seem at that time. We just felt like we had something to prove, you know. Out of that, you know, these guys came on board, which was, yeah, like you said, an incredibly high compliment. And they said it should be a half hour. And we were like, okay, yeah, I mean, we'll give it a go. And then through those guys also, we signed with, because then William Morris, WME, saw it. They liked it a lot. And I guess they played it at like their staff meeting or whatever, and they all laughed. And so then they brought us in there, and then they like signed us, you know, as clients, which was super cool. And then we wrote it as this half hour, and then we went out with them and pitched it to a lot of like cable networks and all kinds of stuff. And I think it works great as a half hour. I just think that it was all so fast, and like this is the correct next step is to actually do what we're doing now, which is we sold it to Endemol, which is kind of this huge, you know, production company and whatever. But what they want is this kind of premium online content. And so we're going to make it like 5 minutes now, which is, I think, the proper next step to take from 90 seconds. I think the jump from 90 seconds to a half hour at the time was a bit steep for Alex and I. And I think we wrote a great pilot, but it might have been a little too intense for some people. Anyway, Endemol came on board and swooped it up. And basically, yeah, they're financing us for this new season.
That's freaking awesome.
Yeah.
I love hearing stories like this because it just shows when you stay true to your passion and what it is that you really, really enjoy and love to do, so many people pick off on that energy and they just start gravitating towards you and your work. And then you ended up landing an agent as well. Like, wow.
I know.
That's freaking awesome.
Yeah, it was totally crazy. It was very like reassuring, you know, just the whole thing was really reassuring in that. It was a huge validation about what you're saying, you know, of just like just doing the work for the work, following your heart, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, it really did. Yeah, it was in that way kind of a profound experience for Alex and I because we were just made it. And then like all these people sort of like swooped in and we were like, oh, shit, I guess that's like the way to make things. You know,
that's so cool. I love that we ended off on that note. I'd like to know, what is a book that you recommend to our listeners?
At the time for me, Robert McKee's story was very cool and I think is a good read. I mean, right now, what I've kind of been into is actually the Poetics by Aristotle as a sort of reference point, just because it's very reassuring when you find someone that long ago talking about the same shit that's happening now in stories, same problems, you know, it's the same principles. And obviously he was a pretty smart guy. So I've been revisiting that one, and as well as reading an interview book that was compiled by Ingmar Bergman of himself. He kind of organized a book of interviews of himself that he basically chose. I think it was these young students who, I don't know, I guess he liked, and he would meet with them throughout the years. He would meet with them and kind of let them ask him questions, and he talked about his films and his process and stuff. And so I've been into that because I like his movies.
Do you remember what the title of that was?
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure, but let me grab it. It's in my bedroom next to my bed.
Yay!
It's called Bergman on Bergman.
Awesome. Okay, I'll make sure to write that down and link it.
And I think the biggest one that I think I have actually in terms of a book that I actually look back to sometimes just for like a little inspiration is the interview book that written by Ray Carney on John Cassavetes, just because however you even feel about John Cassavetes' films, I think just he's such a cool guy and his philosophy about filmmaking, what he was after, is so great. And I find that one particularly, you know, speaks to me often. Like that's one that has sustained the test of time, right? I feel like I could keep picking that book up over the next 10 years and reading the stuff that he's talking about and being like, oh yeah, oh shit, yeah, like he's so right, you know?
You gave us quite a few books, a lot more than I expected. Yeah, you gave us three. Lucky number three. So thank you for that, Morgan. Tell us where we can find you on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or all of them to say hi.
Yeah, it was super fun. So my Twitter is Morganism with two Z's. MORGANIZZM. And then that's also, I think, my Facebook. And then I think my Instagram is just Morgan Krantz.
That wraps it up, guys. A huge thank you to you listeners for listening in. And a huge thank you to Morgan for being so generous and open about his filmmaking journey. And I hope you found his episode educational and empowering. For links to the book and all the resources that were brought up in Morgan's episode, be sure to head over to his show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Morgan Krantz. That's MORGANKRANTZ. Thank you guys so much again for listening in and joining me on this journey. I'm so grateful to all of you.
As mentioned at the top of this episode, I'd love for you to get to know the team behind Scrivener. We have Julia Pierce, the head of marketing, with us today to talk a little bit about Scrivener. Julia, I'm so happy to have you on the show right now. I'm such a huge fan of Scrivener. Funny thing is, I actually learned about you guys through one of my guests I interviewed for the show. She's a best-selling novelist of an Oprah's Editor's Pick and an O. Henry Prize winner. So yeah, you better believe that I most definitely checked out the software she uses for her writing. I'm so grateful to her for mentioning you guys, and I'm so thrilled to have you as an official sponsor of 88 Cups of Tea. So let's get right into it. Tell me how Scrivener has helped you with your work and what do you love about it?
The idea behind Scrivener is that it was developed for writers. My background's in journalism, so it's really, really helped me. For instance, when you're writing a feature, you might have different sources, you might have different interviews with different people. The beauty of Scrivener is that it allows you to get everything into one place. So beforehand, you might have had a few files in Microsoft Word, you might have had some stuff on a spreadsheet in Excel, and you're sort of thinking to yourself, oh, I know I made some notes about this, and I know I spoke to this person, but what did I call that file? I'm searching through my computer, I can't find anything. But with Scrivener, you can drag it all into one folder. Everything's in one place at your fingertips. So whenever you're looking for something, you can just do it straight away. And you can pull in things like videos, you can pull in audio files as well. So it's a very, very flexible tool. A lot of writing software is built with a particular style in mind or going through a particular process. You may have to fill in character sheets and so on before you can actually get into the software itself and start writing. We don't believe in that at all. What we think is that everybody writes, all writers are completely different. They have their own individual styles and ways of doing things. So the idea behind Scrivener is that Scrivener doesn't get in the way. It molds to your style. You think about how you would like to write, whether you like to plan everything first or whether you like to just sit there and write everything and then at the end go, now I need to organize everything, now I need to go back and edit and think, did I say Steve had blue eyes at the beginning and now he's a tall man with dark eyes? And I'm sure everybody who's listening who's an author knows, oh yeah, continuity. We have all these things within the program. You just mold it to whatever you need to do, really.
Yeah, that's what I love about Scrivener too. I actually jumped into your software thinking it was just for people who wanted to write books, but I realized a few days into that, it's so perfect for any kind of writing, any kind of research and organization. It's actually perfect, especially for someone like me who's so scatterbrained with all these ideas and thoughts I need to collect and jot down. And you guys have made my life so much easier because I used to get so annoyed having to switch back and forth between all of my documents that were stacked on top of each other one by one at the very bottom of my desktop screen. So then you'd have to kind of like skim through and look through and keep clicking all these buttons. So I would always lose my train of thought because I was so busy trying to find all these hidden images and PDFs and Word documents. So just a few days into using Scrivener, I realized really quickly that not only can I use it for a more organized way of getting ideas down for a novel, but I've also used it to create the content for my podcast's website and setting up contracts and even business emails. I feel like every time I use Scrivener, I always discover brand new features and I'm like, whoa, where did that one come from? I'm sure there's a lot more features that I'm not aware of yet. So why don't you tell us about one of your absolute favorite features on Scrivener?
Actually, the one feature that I really do like is when you go into the cork board and you can stamp each individual card with a message sort of like done, needs editing, final draft, something like that. I just find it really, really easy to go back through chapters of things that I'm writing and just to quickly flick onto cork board view and just see, actually, no, I've done that. It's nice to be able to see your progress as you go through and just mark that done, done, done. It's just the way my mind's organized.
Yeah, definitely just go for it. I actually went through the Active tutorial myself and it really helped a lot in figuring out how to use Scrivener because it can be overwhelming in the beginning. And I'll also have to jump on the video tutorials because that sounds really helpful too. So thank you so much for sharing your take on Scrivener, Julia. And that wraps it up, guys. As you can see, I'm so proud to partner with Scrivener as I really do believe in them. And if you haven't used them yet, I really encourage you to download their free trial and check it out for yourself. I want this tool to help you as much as it's helped me. So if you decide that you do love it, Scrivener has a very special offer just for our Storyteller Tribe. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Scrivener and enter promo code 88cupsoftea at the checkout page for a 20% off discount.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!